gatherings without their husbands. And, as advisor to the English club, Mr. Ramsay was supposed to serve as host. Mrs. Ramsay said he had a touch of the flu and wanted her to stand in for him and pay his respects should Robert Frost appear. I heard her tell this to some masters and their wives as she carried a plate of cookies around the crowded room. Then she said it to Bill White and me, in the same words, and with the same helpless shrug, pursing her lips in sympathy for her ailing husband. Bill and I were standing by the fireplace. We each picked a cookie. And as she told her brave little lie, Bill reached out and took the plate from her and set it on the mantel, below the picture of the Blaine boys. She relaxed and made no move to go. I was struck by Bill's confidence. Somehow I didn't like it, but the result was fine, having Mrs. Ramsay linger with us. She said she'd heard Frost read once before, when she was a student at Foxcroft, and afterward he'd met with the girls and talked about everything under the sun. It was very funny, which surprised her, though she supposed it shouldn't have, and a terrible flirt. Of course, he got plenty of encouragement. The heat from the fire brought a flush to her face and made her perfume thicker, headier. She turned to Mr. Rice, an English master, and a southerner himself, who was tapping the ashes from his pipe into the fireplace. "Do you think he'll come tonight?" she asked. "Frost? I doubt it. He seemed pretty well played out by the end there." "Shoot," she said. She glanced toward the door as another group of boys came in, then turned toward Mr. Rice. "Ramsay says y'all bringing that Ayn Rand woman here." "Me bringing Ayn Rand? What would Mrs. Rice say?" "You know what I mean." Bill and I looked at each other. "There may have been some talk about it," Mr. Rice said. "Oh, go on. It's true, and you know it." "Roberta." I know," she said. "Boys, you didn't hear a word. But still, Ayn Rand. Honestly now, Roberta, have you read anything of hers?" "Why, sure." "Well, not a whole bunch. A little. Well, a couple of pages of one book in a drugstore. Well, I guess you'd have to say I haven't really." "Nor have I," Mr. Rice said, "and until I do, I will refrain from poisoning these innocents against her." "I've read her," Bill said. We all looked at him. "The discerning Mr. White. I am shocked," Mrs. Ramsay said, but I could see that she was amused by the coolness with which he claimed this dubious ground. "She has some interesting ideas," he said. Just then, some of the boys started to sing, and others chimed in, the masters and their wives looking on tenderly. When I first arrived here, I had tried not to gape whenever a bunch of boys suddenly gave voice like this, on the bus coming home from a game, in a sound-swelling stone hallway. It was like being in a movie of some Viennese operetta, where everybody in the hotel lobby bursts into song, the doorman in his field marshal's coat chiming in with a comical solo. Now I too knew the songs and quickened to those moments when we leaned together, watching one another for cues, and joined our voices. The singers began to gather around the fireplace. Mr. Rice gave way and drifted back toward the other masters. But Mrs. Ramsay stayed with us and was soon surrounded by the chorus we'd become. She swayed to the music, laughing softly at a witty stanza, closing her eyes at a romantic line. She didn't so much listen to the songs as receive them, as if we were serenading her. And indeed we were. She was a woman alone among us, eyes shining, color high, a pretty woman made beautiful by tribute of song. We could see our power to charm her, and make her beautiful, and this gave boldness to our voices. All the poetry of the night, the agitating nearness of this young woman, the heat of the clove-scented room, and the knowledge of the cold outside. All this was somehow to be heard in the songs we addressed to her. It was exciting, and not quite proper, stirring and in some way illicit. It was a kind of ravishing. When one of the masters called a halt to it after several numbers, only as an afterthought, pleading the lateness of the hour, we broke off, as if coming out of a trance, hardly knowing where we were. Mrs. Ramsey seemed a little dazed herself and skittish. She collected some dirty cups and wandered back to the cider bowl, where I saw her in conversation with the Greek master's elderly wife. The next time I looked, she was gone. It was obvious that Frost wouldn't show. Still, I stayed until the end, even offered to help with the cleanup. But the wives stuffed my pockets with cookies and sent me packing. After breakfast, I chanced some demerits and skipped my warm, easy chore, helping sort that morning's mail, to join a crew of third-formers who'd been assigned the job of rolling and lining the clay tennis courts overlooking the headmaster's garden. They glanced at me curiously but said nothing, these melancholy squirts with pallid faces, hunched deep in the coats they were supposed to grow into. After a brief show of helping, I broke off and stood by the fence, watching the garden. I kept my vigil for half an hour or so. No one came. I figured George had chickened out after all, the big baby. But I was wrong. We walked to our dorm together after dinner that night. George couldn't hold a grudge, and he told me he'd spent over an hour alone with Frost in the headmaster's parlor. They'd started talking and never made it outside. Frost hadn't said much about George's poem, not in so many words anyway, but he recited a few of his own and gave George some pointers. He also gave him an inscribed copy of his Complete Poems and an invitation to drop by for a visit, should he ever find himself in the neighborhood. "Ah," I said, "great." We walked along. Then George said that Frost had left him with some advice. What was that? "Do you know where Kamchatka is?" "Not exactly. Alaska? Somewhere up there?" Mr. Frost told me I was wasting my time in school. He said I should go to Kamchatka. Or Brazil. Kamchatka? Why Kamchatka? Why Brazil? He didn't explain. He was going to, but then he had to leave. Jesus. Kamchatka? Kamchatka. Later that night, I went to the library and looked it up. A peninsula in the remote far east of the Soviet Union, on the Bering Sea. Very few people lived there. It was dark half the year. They lived on the salted meat of salmon, and also of bears, which greatly outnumbered the people, and proved a sorrow to the unwary. When the taiga wasn't frozen over, it swarmed with biting insects. There were many volcanoes, and they were still active. The only picture in the Kamchatka entry showed two figures in parkas watching the top of a mountain being carried skyward on a fist of flame. I closed the encyclopedia and sat listening to the wind rattle the mullioned panes behind me. What was it about Kamchatka that a young writer should forsake his schooling to go there? A spectacle, maybe. The drama of strange people living strangely? Danger? Well, all this could be good matter for stories and poems. But Frost himself had lived in New England all his life, at no cost to his art, and I wondered if he'd ever even been there. I guessed not. But it meant something to him, Kamchatka. Something to do with the writer's life and... And what else could it mean but hardship? Solitude, darkness, and hardship. But he had also mentioned Brazil. I rose from my deep chair and crossed the room past boys dozing over books and exchanged the K volume for B. Ubermensch. The rumor was true. Ayn Rand would be our next visiting writer. Some of the masters were sore enough about this to let the story of their failed protest sift down to steerage. It seemed that the chairman of the Board of Trustees, Hiram Dufresne, an admirer of Rand's novels, had insisted on the invitation. Mr. Dufresne was also very rich and rained money on the school, most recently the new science building and the Wardell Memorial Hockey Rink, named in honor of his roommate here who had been killed in the war. He visited often and liked to give the blessing before meals, serving up plenty of these and thous and thines, and afterward he would join us in Blaine Hall and lend his surprisingly high voice to the singing. A big, happy-looking man with an obvious orange hairpiece and a shiny round face and little square teeth like a baby's. He once stopped me on the quad to ask where I hailed from and how I liked the school. And as I gave my gushing answers, he smiled and closed his eyes like a purring cat. The headmaster invited Ayn Rand, so the story went, only because he was about to start a drive for scholarship funds and needed Mr. Dufresne's support. A small party of masters came to object, and Mr. Ramsey used an impertinent metaphor, at which point the headmaster blew up and sent them home with hard feelings against both him and Dean Makepeace, who'd taken his side. It was a measure of their resentment that these masters let us hear so much about this dispute. Ayn Rand would visit in early February. By the time the announcement went out just before Christmas break, I'd already heard the story behind it and was trying to figure out who held the high ground. Was the headmaster selling out? Or were these masters indulging a Mandarin snobbery, regardless of the result? As a scholarship boy, I knew how I'd feel about losing my shot because some pedant wanted to show off his exquisite taste. But I was also affected by the master's conviction that Ayn Rand simply did not belong in the company of Robert Frost or Catherine Ann Porter or Edmund Wilson or Edna St. Vincent Millay or any of the other visitors whose photographs hung in the foyer of Blaine Hall. The school, they believed, would lose no less than part of its soul by playing host to her. And to them, the money made it even worse. Whoring after strange gods, as Mr. Ramsey supposedly had put it. By now, I'd picked up enough swank to guess that Ayn Rand was as bad as she was popular. And she was very popular. In a smirky spirit, I pulled a copy of The Fountainhead off a book rack in the train station as I was leaving for Christmas break, read a few pages for laughs, forgot to laugh, and got so caught up I decided to buy it. There was still a man ahead of me at the cash register when the conductor began his last call. The clerk was old and slow, damn his eyes. I stood there in a sweat, knowing I should give up and leave, but unable to surrender the novel. In the end, I made the train at a dead run, suitcases nearly wrenching my arms out of their sockets. But I had it, the fat book swinging in my raincoat pocket, banging against my thigh. I was bound for Baltimore to spend the holidays with my mother's father and his wife. The pokey local was packed with boys from school. And on any other trip, I would have been horsing around with the rest of them. But this time, I found a nearly empty car and settled in with a novel. At the next stop down the line, we took out a bunch of girls from Miss Cobb's academy. I watched them milling around on the platform, waiting to board, and I saw a girl I'd met at their Halloween dance. Her name was Lorraine. Rain, as she called herself. By the third slow dance, we'd been pushing up close together. So close that one of the monitors, wandering the floor, tapped me on the shoulder with her pointer. which meant we had to retreat to opposite sides of the room and couldn't dance with each other again. Later, I saw her making out with my classmate, Jack Broom, which didn't stop me from writing her an ironically jocular letter a few days later. She never wrote back. Whenever I thought of that letter, as I often did, every phrase glowed with stupidity, made even more garish by the dead silence of its reception. Rain came into my car, another girl at her elbow. Cigarette smoke curled from her nostrils. They stopped in the doorway and looked the car over. Her friend said something, and Rain laughed. Then she saw me and stopped. She was thrown. So was I. I had to force myself not to look away. A few weeks ago, I'd been nudging a boner against her, and she'd been sort of nudging back, the two of us holding this thing between us like an apple in some birthday game. Then she betrayed me and snubbed me. Now what? I could see her decide to brazen it out. She said something to the other girl and came down the aisle, steadying herself on the seat backs, long camel overcoat swaying to the rhythmic sideways lurch of the train. She was a redhead, with beautifully arched eyebrows and pouty lips, her pale forehead faintly stippled with acne scars. When she talked to you, she leaned back and narrowed her eyes as if sizing you up. She stopped beside me and asked where I was going. And when I said Baltimore, she wondered if I knew some friend of hers who lived there. I repeated the name thoughtfully, then said, "No, I didn't think I knew her." "Well, you should," Rain said. "She's stupendous great fun. I'll tell her to look out for you." "Terrific." She dropped her cigarette and ground it out, her leg flashing forward from the pleats of her skirt. She had on black stockings. Then she glanced back at her friend. "Well," she said. "Oh, don't tell me," she plucked the novel off my lap. "Do not tell me you're reading this book." Well, it seemed useless to deny it. She flipped through the pages, then stopped and began to read. "Oh, God," she said, and went on reading, long enough for her friend to look impatient. I waited, smiling idiotically. "Dominique is my spirit guide," Rain said. "You know what I mean?" "Well, sure," I said. "Absolutely." "Rourke, too," she said, "but in a different way. I have a completely different thing with Rourke. I'm not even going to try to describe that." "I know what you mean," I said, then added, "probably like I have with Dominique." Her friend called out and jerked her head toward the next car. Rain held the book out, then pulled it back. "Can I borrow it? I don't have a thing to read." "No, afraid not." "Please," then in a low voice. "Pretty please?" "No, sorry." She looked at me in that measuring way of hers. Maybe she was wondering whether I would take the book by force if I had to. She came up with the right answer. "Okay," she said, and handed it over. Rain hadn't bothered to close the book. I glanced over the pages she'd been reading and found this exchange between Dominique and Rourke. "I want to be owned, not by a lover, but by an adversary who will destroy my victory over him, not with honorable blows, but with a touch of his body on mine. That is what I want of you, Rourke. That is what I am. You wanted to hear it all. You heard it. What do you wish to say now? Take off your clothes." I read without stopping until we pulled into New York, where I took an empty bench in the station and went back to the book as my schoolmates played the fool around me. One boy had gotten plastered on the train and was puking into an ashtray, and a couple of others were pretending to be drunk. What sheep! It was dark when I boarded the train to Baltimore. Now and then I stopped reading to study my reflection in the window. His face was like a law of nature, a thing one could not question, alter, or implore. It had high cheekbones over gaunt, hollow cheeks, gray eyes, cold and steady, a contemptuous mouth, shut tight, the mouth of an executioner or a saint. My cheeks weren't hollow, and my eyes weren't gray, but my mouth surely tightened with contempt over the next weeks as I read and reread The Fountainhead and considered how shabbily this world treats a man who is strong and great simply because he's strong and great. A man like the architect Howard Roark, who refuses to change even one angle of a design to advance his career, and who, when his finest work, a housing project, is secretly modified during construction, goes there and personally dynamites the whole thing to smithereens, rather than let people live in such mongrelized spaces. His genius is not for sale. He is a free man among parasites who hate him and punish him with poverty and neglect. And he has sex with Dominique. Dominique seems like a regular glacier as she rolls over the men in her path. With her air of cold serenity and her exquisitely vicious mouth, she treats Roark like dirt, talking tough to him, even smacking his face with a branch. But underneath, she's dying for him, and he knows it. And one night, he goes to her room and gives Dominique exactly what she wants, with her fighting him all the way, because part of what she wants is to be broken by Roark. Taken. This was new and interesting to me. The idea that a woman's indifference, even her scorn, might be an invitation to go a few rounds. I felt like a sucker. It seemed that all my routine gallantries and attentions had marked me as a weakling, a slave. I was discovering the force of my will. To read The Fountainhead was to feel this caged power straining like a dammed-up river to break loose and crush every impediment to its free running. I understood that nothing stood between me and my greatest desires, nothing between me and greatness itself, but the temptation to doubt my will and bow to counsels of moderation, expedience, and conventional morality, and shrink into the long, slow death of respectability. That was where the contempt came in. I had stayed with my grandfather and his wife on other vacations and found them kindly but dull. Grand John was a retired Air Force colonel whose specialty had been photoanalysis. While studying pictures of German trains during the war, he'd spotted a certain marking that led to an important bombing run. My mother told me that story. Grand John didn't tell stories. After the war, he'd worked in an office at the Pentagon before getting put out to pasture. At first, I'd attributed his blandness to a professional habit of secrecy and made it romantic, monotony as cover. This time, though, I watched Grand John and his wife with a cold eye. How could he have spent so many years in the Air Force without learning to fly? 30 years around Mustangs and Tomcats and Sabrejets, and he seemed happy to pilot a desk to his retirement party. Patty was his second wife, a friend of my grandmother's who'd married him after Grand Margie died. Patty was boring, too. She read him the day's news while he peered at the crossword puzzle through his half-moon glasses. "They say they're going to widen the road where that car went off with all those kids." She had covered the floors of their house in thick white carpets that deadened the air and made whatever you said in that woolen silence sound like the sudden caw of a crow on a damp day. I began to feel their kindness as a form of aggression. Patty was pitilessly solicitous. I couldn't touch a book without getting grilled about the sufficiency of light and the comfort of the chair. Was I warm enough? Did I need a pillow for my back? How about one of the 5,000 Cokes they'd stored up in anticipation of my visit? Grandchild kept telling me how lucky I was to have my mother's eyes and how proud of me she would have been. Sometimes I had to go into the bathroom and scream silently, rocking from side to side like a gorilla, my head thrown back, my teeth bared. This, I decided, this sadistic dullness, this excruciating compulsion to please, was how you ended up after a lifetime of getting A's in obedience school. Rourke had worked in a quarry, hewing granite blocks with a chisel, rather than take a job doing tame architecture. He refused to think as others would have him think. Had Grandchild ever done anything else? Had Patty ever thought at all? Christ, how could they last another hour like this without cutting each other's throats? I fled the house every chance I got, riding a bus the 10 miles into Baltimore from Wilton Oaks, their housing development. It rained steadily through Christmas into the new year. I walked the glistening streets in a fury of derision, wet and cold, sneering at everyone except the drunkards and bums, who at least had the guts not to buy into the sham. Despising any sign of uniformity, I saw uniforms everywhere, not only on soldiers and policemen, but on high school girls and housewives out shopping. The businessmen struck me as especially pathetic, in their hats and suits and London fogs, each with some laughable flag of individuality hanging from his neck. The fountainhead made me alert to the smallest surrenders of will. Passing a shoe store, I saw a young salesman in the act of bending over a customer's foot. I stopped by the window and stared at him, hoping he'd sense my rage and disgust. "You, is this your dream? To grovel before strangers, to stuff their corns and bunions into hush puppies? And for what? A roof overhead, and 3 squares a day? Coward! Fool! Men were born to soar, and you have chosen to kneel." But he never looked my way. Instead, he continued to chat up his customer, a grizzled old guy in overalls, all the while cradling the man's stockinged foot in one hand, examining it as if it were an object of interest and value. The salesman laughed at something the geezer said, then lowered the foot gently to the sizing stool. He rose and walked toward the back of the store. The old guy, smiling to himself, fingers laced across his stomach, stared past me into the street. I returned to school 3 or 4 days before we were actually due back. Only a few boys were around, luckless scholars retaking tests they'd flunked, red-eyed swimmers tuning up for the season. Otherwise, the place was deserted. My reason for cutting the break short wasn't just to get away from Grandchild and Patty. Our entries for the Ayn Rand competition were due the 3rd week of January, and I wanted to get a jump on my story before classes started. But I wrote nothing. I took long walks through the snowy woods and fields, watching myself do it, admiring my solitude as if from a great height. Like Howard Rourke, I kept a cigarette clamped in my executioner's lips. Once I got a safe distance from the campus, and between these bouts of passionate striding, I pigged out with the jocks at the training table and lay on my bed reading The Fountainhead for the 3rd time. I wasn't writing, but that didn't trouble me. I knew I could deliver my story when the time came. What I was doing was tanking up on self-certainty, transfusing Rourke's arrogant, steely spirit into my own. And as I read the book, I could feel it happen, my sense of originality and power swelling as my mouth resumed its tightness of contempt. For once I had a complete picture of the world. Over here, a few disdainful Rourkes and a few icy Dominiques, meltable only by Rourkes. Over there, a bunch of terrified nobodies running from their own possibilities. Now and then, I caught glimpses of other ideas in the novel. Political, philosophical ideas. But I didn't think them through. It was the personal meaning that had me enthralled. The promise of mastery achieved by doing exactly as I pleased. When classes started, I still hadn't begun my story. And the longer I went without writing, the more convinced I became of its inevitable superiority. By now, I was reading The Fountainhead for the fourth time, my confidence at a boil as I fell behind in my assignments and picked up demerits for missing chapel and chores. Bill had to prod me to keep my side of the room halfway neat. And one afternoon, he confiscated the novel and wouldn't give it back until I'd picked up the mess around my bed. "Man, you're really hot on this stuff, aren't you?" "She's good," I said. "She's damned good. She's okay." "Okay? Come on. I distinctly remember you saying how interesting she is." "I said she had some interesting ideas. Have you read her other book?" Atlas shrugged. "Not yet. I will." "It's all right, I guess. Same kind of thing. More speeches. Longer speeches. It kind of got on my nerves, actually. All that Übermensch stuff." The German word shut me up. Our history master used it often, too often, really, and with excessive pleasure in his accent, to describe the Nazis' ideology. Because of this association, when Bill flashed the word, I became instantly conscious of his Jewishness, and all the more so because he kept it to himself. I could have argued that a man with a mind of his own and a pair of balls to back it up didn't have to be a Nazi, but of course Bill hadn't actually said that. And something else made me hold my tongue. He knew that I'd caught on to his Jewishness, but he wasn't aware of mine, such as it was. I didn't want to say something that would touch so tender a nerve, a tenderness I assumed in him because I suffered from it myself, covertly bristling when I read or heard anything that might be construed as anti-Semitic. In fact, that part of my blood felt most truly my own at just those moments when it seemed liable to condescension or ridicule. I figured Bill had kindred feelings, and I didn't want to provoke them by pushing a view that he identified with German murderers. Our balance was fragile enough anyway, with so many complications of ambition and envy and pretense. The crowning irony was that Bill himself should appear so much the poster Aryan, so blonde, so fair, so handsome. More than handsome. Over the past months he had become beautiful. How had that happened? What had changed? Here, too, my secret knowledge of him cast a shadow, because what made him beautiful was a quality of melancholy that softened his gaze and the set of his mouth, and that I attributed to his Jewishness. It seemed to me that the other Jewish boys in school were subject to a similar poignance of expression, intermittently, of course, and some more than others, but all of them to a degree. It was one of the marks of their apartness. As the submission deadline approached, I entered a fever of elation, as if Ayn Rand had already chosen my story. I literally had chills. My brow was hot and clammy. I began to hear the voices of my characters and see their faces. It was all coming together, a great story, a masterpiece. The day before it was due, without having committed a word of it to paper, I rose to read a passage of L'Étranger in my French class, and my head kept floating up until it reached a zone of absolute silence, and the faces turned toward me looked as featureless as plates of dough. Then my knees went watery, and I reached out to steady myself, but fell anyway, bringing my desk down with me. I was all tangled up in it. I tried to sit up and fell back again. And lay there, waiting. They kept me in the infirmary for almost 2 weeks. My fever was not, it turned out, the fizz of genius. It was influenza, complicated by walking pneumonia. Later, once he knew he wasn't going to lose me, the school doctor said that people had been dying of this particular bug, that I was lucky not to have died myself. My dreams were so vivid those first few days that I could hardly tell waking from sleeping. The one thing I could be sure of was the constant presence of Grandjean and Patty, who'd driven up from Baltimore right after the headmaster called them. They took turns at my bedside, sponging my face, helping the nurse feed me and change my sheets, supporting me on my wobbly, dizzying trips to the bathroom. Whenever I woke up, one of them was there. At first, the sight of Patty or Grandjean in the chair beside me made me weepy with gratitude. But as my head cleared, I got tired of them and worried that they were imposing their dullness on the masters and boys who dropped by to say hello and telling them more about me than I wanted known. Then, one morning, the nurse brought in a box of chocolates with a tender farewell note from Patty and a copy of Advise and Consent, Grandjean had inscribed, to the budding writer. "The colonel left these off for you," the nurse said. "Didn't want to wake you up." "Nice fella, the colonel. Fine figure of a man." I watched her set up my breakfast, a brisk, gum-chewing blonde with strong red hands. Her shoulder brushed mine as she cranked the bed upright, humming to herself, and I became aware of her as a woman. I knew my grandfather still made love to Patty. I'd heard their headboard banging the wall as I lay reading, and it embarrassed me, mostly for Patty's sake. She seemed too old for this. I thought of her as a victim in the transaction. But Grandjean was still, as the nurse said, a fine figure of a man, tall and strong and jut-jawed, and I could sense his pleasure in the company of women. The nurse obviously had responded with pleasure of her own. I couldn't help thinking of their hours alone here, among all these empty beds, the nurse and the colonel. And this thought, framed in that impersonal, tritely pornographic way, made me raw with suspicious envy. She must have caught it in my face, because she gave me an amused sidelong glance and flicked my shoulder with the napkin before dropping it in my lap. That afternoon, a third former who'd just been admitted to the infirmary told me that Purcell had won the audience with Ayn Rand. We were playing chess in the sunroom, and I bent low over the board so he couldn't see my face. Not that I'd even submitted anything. Indeed, by now I could hardly remember the story I'd been so sure of. Most of it had vanished with the fever, leaving only traces of plot like the outlines in a coloring book. Since I couldn't have won, it followed that someone else would. So why not Purcell? Talented, serious Purcell. Purcell, who cared so much. Over the next few days, I scraped together enough generosity to convince myself that I was happy for him. And when I got discharged, the first thing I did was stop by his room to shake his hand. "What are you talking about?" he said. "I didn't win." "You didn't win? I heard you did." "Well, I didn't. Big Jeff won." "Big Jeff? Big Jeff won?" Purcell's roommate was all pretzeled over in a chair cutting his toenails. He looked up and said, "How's about them apples? Big Jeff, the award-winning author." Purcell looked at him, and he laughed and went back to work with his clippers. They always acted like they hated each other, then signed up as roommates again every year. "I can't believe it," I said. Purcell was lying on his bed. He lowered the book he'd been reading and stared up at the ceiling. "Jesus," I said. "Big Jeff. Did you submit anything?" "Yes, I have to admit I did. I actually put myself in the position of being judged by Ayn Rand." "Oh, bull, have you even read her?" He didn't answer. "You haven't seen Big Jeff's story?" the roommate said to me. "No, I've been sort of out of commission." He looked at Purcell and smiled. "It's a classic," he said. Schoolboys will be parsing its subtleties for generations to come. Purcell closed his eyes. So Big Jeff won, I said. Too much. I didn't know Big Jeff could write. He can't, Purcell said. Then why did she choose him? He just shook his head, eyes still closed. I'll tell you why, the roommate said. Because the blood of an artist runs in Big Jeff's veins. Because he's a two-fisted, bigger-than-life, award-winning author, and not one of your local artistes who give themselves orgasms by forswearing capital letters and boring the living shit out of everybody. That's why. He bent toward his desk and picked up a copy of the school paper. Here, he said. Read him and weep. Big Jeff's story was called The Day the Cows Came Home, and it managed to combine his vegetarianism with his interest in space travel. It went like this. A flying saucer lands in a field outside Boston. The police and various armed services try to destroy it, without success. Then it fires a ray that atomizes a nearby truck, mercifully empty. And everyone backs off while an exhaustively described robot disembarks and demands that a delegation of world leaders present themselves to the saucer's commander tomorrow or else. Old hat so far, but not for long. The next day, the president, the Soviet premier, and the Queen of England assemble in the field and are led by the robot to the command center. And what do they find there, sitting at the controls and surrounded by a crew of the same species, but an enormous bull? This is no ordinary bull, but a horned argonaut of imperial carriage whose eyes flash with preternatural intelligence, and who otherwise bears the same resemblance to earthly bovines that the untrammeled wolf, bold ruler of his arctic realm, bears to the permed and coiffured poodle in his rhinestone sweater. Then the world's leaders get the story. Long ago, one of the aliens' ships had developed engine trouble and been directed to our planet because of its nutritious flora. Their own galaxy was light years away, and by now the crew would have been dead for scores of centuries. But this expedition had come to gather the descendants of that valiant band and take them home. They had left descendants, hadn't they? The perils of answering this question are not lost on the humans. They deny any knowledge of such creatures until the ship's commander produces a picture of cows in a field, at which point the Queen of England, her tender female spirit unequal to the sternness of his gaze, breaks down and babbles out the truth. The travelers gathered around her are not pleased to learn the present state of their kin or the uses to which they've been put. Indeed, they can hardly believe their ears, and the commander insists on a fact-finding tour. He visits a dairy in Wisconsin, where he sees the cows sucked dry by machines and shot full of sperm from bulls they've never even met. He watches calves being castrated and branded in Texas, and tours a farm in Japan where the animals are force-fed gallons of beer to sweeten their flesh. He's taken to a messy bullfight in Mexico, a rodeo in Wyoming, and a killing floor in the Chicago stockyards. The commander of the spaceship sees all this and more. He grows ominously silent. After returning to the ship to confer with his comrades, he emerges to make a grand tour of all the ranches and farms, gathering the herds around him to tell them exactly what lies in store. If they don't accept his invitation to return to the home planet, they retain just enough of the old language to understand the warning. But most of them shrug it off. Instead, they invite him to join them. They've got it made. All they can eat, protection from predators, medical care, the works. The commander is reviled as a troublemaker, and in Montana, a bunch of steers stampede him off the ranch. Finally, only a handful of the bravest and smartest choose to leave. And even this small procession is diminished when some of them lose their nerve at the sight of the long ramp leading into the ship and defect. At sunset, the saucer lifts off with its crew and their newfound cousins. But they don't head for home. Not yet. They hang up there for a while, putting their ray to work. The killing is efficient, implacable, and completely misanthropic. In the end, not a single human being remains alive. The story concludes with this line, spoken by one of the crew to a cow, weeping for the little boy who milked her. He's lucky we didn't eat him. In her front page interview, Ayn Rand praised Big Jeff as a great writer in the making. "It is most gratifying," she said, "to see someone of Mr. Purcell's youth dare to challenge the collectivist orthodoxy that tyrannizes intellectual life in this country, and nowhere more than in its colleges and schools. Mr. Purcell excels in his depiction of the victim kissing the whip. Of course, the herd denies the truth of its own enslaved condition and attacks the heroic truth-teller. One need only read the reviews of Atlas Shrugged to see that principle at work in our so-called free press, which can appear free only to those who've been completely brainwashed by egalitarian mystifications. But just look what happens when truly superior men, like John Galt, cease to exercise their powers. The whole world comes to a halt." Ayn Rand spent most of the interview going on about this John Galt. Since I didn't know who he was, I skipped to the end, where she came back to Big Jeff and complimented his use of the farm and the stockyard as a metaphor for the welfare state, whose siren song lures us ever closer to the wasteland of coerced mediocrity, where to be done for matters more than to do, where freedom is a fantasy achieved by shutting one's eyes to the corral in which one lives, and where the herd counts itself fortunate to be fattened on the proceeds of its own eventual slaughter. Mr. Purcell has here revealed a great and most unpopular truth. The dream of universal equality leads not to paradise, but to Auschwitz. I couldn't shake the flu. My nose was red and swollen from uncontrollable fits of honking, my eyes weepy, my upper lip chapped. I dozed off constantly. 2 days before Ayn Rand's visit, I was nudged awake by my Latin master and told, not unkindly, to check myself back into the infirmary until I got well enough to keep my eyes open in class. Ayn Rand gave her talk in the afternoon. I thought of sneaking out for it, but the nurse kept fussing through my room, and then I fell asleep and didn't wake up until Bill White dropped by after it was over. He meant to cheer me up, of course, but instead left me desolate for everything I'd missed. He said that a bunch of Ayn Rand's followers had driven up from Boston and waited over an hour in the snow, smoking like chimneys, dropping their butts everywhere, so they could grab the front seats. "They look like a bunch of undertakers," Bill said. "Even the women, all of them silent and unsmiling in their dark clothes. During the talk, they applauded at odd times and generally made a stir. But not as much as Ayn Rand." Right away, she tore into our school motto, "Give all," and urged everyone to ignore such drivel and live for themselves alone. Then she rebuked Hiram Dufresne for calling her a conservative in his introduction. She said that she was a radical, not a conservative, and that people should attach meaning to the words they speak. Toward the end, some students actually walked out when she attacked President Kennedy for inviting us to consider what we might do for our country. Her talk went on too long for questions. But when the headmaster suggested a follow-up meeting in Blaine Hall after dinner, She agreed, on the condition that only her true readers would be welcome. Those who had read all her novels. She was willing to have a serious discussion, she said, but not to answer ignorant questions or be gawked at by tourists. I came in at the last minute to give the masters less time to notice me and send me back to bed. There weren't many, as it happened. A young science master, another from history, the football coach, and Mr. Ramsey, who was officiating at the Punch Bowl, probably as penance for getting mouthy with the headmaster. Mrs. Ramsey stood beside him, talking to Big Jeff. Some 15 boys were scattered around on folding chairs, and an equal number of darkly dressed men and women, Bill's undertakers, no doubt, sat somberly in front of the fireplace. One of the women, a skinny thing with cropped blonde hair, lit a cigarette, and when the football coach asked her to put it out, she took another long drag and flicked it into the fire without even looking at him. The logs popped and hissed. Otherwise, the room was eerily quiet. Then Ayn Rand came in, accompanied by the headmaster and Hiram Dufresne, and a tall, grave young guy with a pompadour. That she was short and blocky surprised me. I'd been expecting Dominique. Her dark hair was cut close, shaped like a helmet. She shrugged off her cape, handed it without a glance to the tall guy, and headed for the Morris chair that had been drawn up for her by the fireplace. Mr. Dufresne began to follow, but she turned toward him and said, quite distinctly, "No further introduction will be necessary, thank you." Her voice was deep and richly accented. Mr. Dufresne stopped and blinked at her, then retreated to the side of the room. Ayn Rand settled into the Morris chair and took a cigarette from her bag and twisted it into a long black holder. One of the men in the front row leaned forward with a lighter. She bent toward the flame, then leaned back and looked us over, her wide red mouth fixed in a skeptical wince. She wore a black suit with a short skirt that rode up her thighs. She had nice legs for a woman so squarely built. A gold pin glittered on her lapel. The smoke from her cigarette drifted up past the picture of the Blaine boys. "So," she said, "how many riders have we among you boys?" The undertakers turned and looked at us. Not a single hand went up. "Come, come," she said. "I know we have at least one. The estimable Mr. Geoffrey Purcell, whom I look forward to meeting." "There must be others." "No?" "Ah, your meek little hearts are afraid to show themselves. Shame on you. You must never be meek. The meek shall inherit nothing but a boot on the neck. You must be bold. My heroes have been ridiculed for refusing fear and compromise. My critics say such people do not exist. But allow me to inform you that I am such a person, and I most assuredly do exist." She drew fiercely on her cigarette and leaned toward us. The light glanced off her gold lapel pin, which I now saw was a dollar sign. "In Russia," she said, "as a student in Petrograd University, I studied by candlelight. There was no firewood. The ink froze in our pens. Mr. Lenin's altruists shot so many of us, we had to rent the coffins in which we carried our teachers and friends to their graves. But I am still here. And why? Not because I kissed the rings of our new Russian popes, I assure you. Not because I gave in to fear. Never. To give in to fear is to be already dead. I refused fear. I refused defeat. Did you know that the fountainhead was rejected 12 times? Imagine! But I did not accept defeat. That is why I am here. For that reason and no other. So please, do not tell me that characters such as mine do not exist. No! She slapped the arm of her chair. No! And please, do not tell me that my characters are unreal. Because they live out their ideals. Of course, the second-handers will tell you that the ideal is impossible. That a real story can only be a story of the folks next door. Those frustrated imbeciles. A story of toad-eaters and mediocrities. A story of compromise and failure. At that moment, the sneeze I'd been trying to hold back exploded wetly. Ayn Rand fixed me with her dark, deep-set eyes as I wiped my raw lip and gave my nose a final clearing blast.